there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, science, and healthcare in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, and answers to your emails and calls. All here for the next hour on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's take a deep breath and talk about some very interesting items that came out in the news. First of all, a warning. In the ultimate irony, the law of unintended consequences has seriously bit us on the behind when it comes to children's death in cars. Now, back in the 1990s, most cars were not equipped with front seat passenger airbags. And so the number of children killed by these devices was exactly zero. In the mid-1990s, as more and more cars were deployed with front passenger airbags, there began to be a rise in pediatric deaths from the airbag exploding and injuring or killing the child. So a campaign was started to put the child in the back in a rear-facing passenger seat, and that has become a very successful campaign. Just about no one doesn't have a rear-facing child seat who has a child. But what has happened in the last decade is that childhood deaths from being forgotten in the car and basically dehydrating or getting heat stroke have gone up. There were 40 deaths in 2010 in the United States from exactly that cause. So we need to increase awareness of this. We've certainly heard it with respect to don't leave your dog in the car, but don't leave your kid in the car either. And people forget. It's not like they're being neglectful. It's just they're under stress, they're in the wrong car, there are some sort of extenuating circumstances. So here are some tips for those parents who have a child in the back seat. And this means everybody, okay? Here are some tips to help you avoid this awful, tragic mishap. First of all, and I like this one a lot, put something that you need, such as your handbag, your briefcase, your cell phone, something on the floorboard in the back seat that you would normally check for before you leave the car. Purse is a good idea. A second advice, which I thought was really good, is get a large stuffed animal and put that in the car seat. Then when you put the child in the car seat, put the stuffed animal in the front passenger seat, and he'll be there to remind you, oh, wait, you're in the front seat. I must have a baby in the back seat. Finally, if you walk by a car and see a child in the back seat and you don't see a parent, don't keep walking. You stop. You can call 911. I think that's the right thing to do. I don't think a parent who leaves a child in the car, even to run into the store for just a minute, doesn't deserve to have 911 called on them. It's just too dangerous and too easy to make that mistake. So never assume that it's okay. Stand there and wait for the parent to come back. And if they don't come back, call 911. This is everyone's social responsibility to keep our children safe. Speaking of social responsibility, this is really great new fodder for research. The company called Kaiser Permanente, which has been the largest and earliest HMO in the country, has a project that's just come to fruition. They have taken 100,000 Kaiser Permanente members who average age 65. They're all long-term Kaiser members who volunteered to do this. Kaiser has data on not just their DNA now, because they've sequenced 900,000 different DNA regions on each Kaiser member sample. So it's pretty thorough DNA. It's not a whole genome, but it's pretty close. And they also measured telomere length. And if you're a regular listener to the show, you know telomeres are the caps on the tips of your chromosomes, which shorten every time your chromosomes divide and effectively create a kind of use-by date. They also seem to be an indicator of stress and real biological age. So having that data, having lifestyle information that's also been entered into the database, and having a comprehensive health database, as well as DNA, is going to just be crazy useful when you start to number crunch. Imagine, for example, that you want to look at drug sensitivity. Suppose there's a cardiac drug that causes problems in a certain small percentage of people. Well, you know who they are because they're your patients and you gave them the drug. You know they filled it at the pharmacy and you know they had the complication. Let's go look in their DNA. Let's see if there is a marker for that complication. And this is really the good side of all those massive databases. I mean, obviously, there's a huge commercial business going on in capturing information about our habits, our behavior, our purchases. Take that technology, take that kind of database management, and the programs obviously are being written, and turn it into searching for health information, searching for ways to improve outcomes, searching for ways to identify vulnerabilities proactively in the population. The great promise of this information is in preventative medicine, in early warning, and I am so excited and just can't wait to see what research and studies they come up with, because it's going to be big. It's the comprehensive database that makes this special. Interesting research this week. Thanks to Lloyd Nelson for his email alerting me to this. We have talked on the air probably a couple of times in the last few years about the concept of qi and how it relates to bioelectrical impulses in the body. And in Chinese medicine, there are these meridians called curious meridians, which are identified with the basic axes of cellular growth. So if you go back to when we were all a little marula or ball of cells, at the point that things start to happen, there's a top, there's a bottom, there's a middle, there's a equator, if you will, in a north and south pole. That's when you start to establish these curious acupuncture meridians. And they're felt to have a great deal to do with how the cells develop. Well, in an oddly related story, Tufts University biologists have been able to measure, and not just measure, but photograph and video bioelectrical signals on tadpoles. Now, these are mutant tadpoles who have cells which are stained with reporter dye, so they can see when there's a depolarization or a hyperpolarization of the cells. So what the top researcher here, whose name is Laura Vandenberg, did was she left the camera on overnight, figuring, oh, well, they'll move and it'll be blurry. But what she captured was she captured the appearance of eyes, nose, and mouth on this ball. It was a color because of the dye, but it was actually measuring bioelectrical change in the cells. This bioelectrical change triggered the development of messenger RNA, which led to the actual development of the face, the eyes, the nose, and the mouth in the location where, I guess frogs don't have noses, but anyway, in the location of where the dots that created the face were seen based on the dye. So this is like bioelectrical signaling triggers DNA production. It's beautiful. I hope she posts it so that we can all look at this really blurry little film showing a face where the face is going to be. It's incredibly cool. I'm going to go to an email. This one I wanted to be sure I got to this week from Joe in Monterey. Joe is 65. He has a BMI of 31, which makes him obese, and he's on blood pressure medicine for 25 years. This morning at 4:30, I woke up with a pain in my jaw, my teeth, down my neck, and across and down my chest. It felt like someone was pressing on my throat. It lasted almost an hour. There was no pain in my left arm, no heart pain. I considered going to the emergency room, but I didn't because about 3 years ago, I had the same symptoms at work and went to the hospital in an ambulance, and I was there 2 days. They did a nuclear film, a stress test, another blood test, and they found no problem. I don't know where to go from here. Thanks for your program. Dear Joe, where you go is straight to a cardiologist, okay? And this is just for the general audience. If you are a male and you are over 50, any chest pain has to be scrutinized. Ideally, you get an EKG when the person has the chest pain. If you can't do that, you try to do an exercise stress test, or barring that, if the person can't exercise, then depending on how suspicious the symptoms sound, you may go so far as to inject a chemical into them to speed their heart up, which can be dangerous. But you've got to find whether there's a blockage. You can't ever sit on chest pain in a high-risk individual, which by definition, Joe is. Age greater than 50, male, that's two risk factors. Blood pressure, whoops, bingo. You've got a third bonus risk factor. You have to treat this as heart disease until proven otherwise. So as far as the false alarm 2 years ago, remember the Aesop's fable about the boy who cried wolf, and don't make the same mistake the villagers made. Let's talk to Pat in Boulder Creek. Hello, Pat, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn. I'm having an episode of severe situs in my right hip. The doctor did some x-rays and said there was a lot of arthritis underneath it. I had not really experienced arthritis before this.
Where is the pain before you go any further? Is it on the outside of the hip, or is it on the groin inside part of the hip?
It started with the groin down in the muscle to my knee.
Okay.
And at first they were saying it was back pain or that it was my psoas muscle.
Mm-hmm.
But then as it went on and I saw different people for trying to get some help for this, finally a doctor said, no, it's not a back problem. It's the bursitis in the trochanter. And then she ordered the x-rays, and that seemed to verify all that.
Well, and, you want to be clear. X-rays won't show bursitis. They'll show arthritis.
Arthritis, yes. Yeah. She showed all the burrs and the arthritis, and that it was, she also said that it showed that the bone was not infected, because that it
sure.
almost felt like the pain was in the bone.
Well, if it's arthritis pain, it basically is in the joint, and the bone does have nerve endings, and it will react to those inflammatory chemicals, so it effectively is in the bone. What question do you have about your situation?
Well, now I am referred to an orthopedist,
yes.
and I am going to be going this week. I understand that probably they will offer me a cortisone injection. I'm real leery about that.
Okay.
And your take on it?
Well, let me start by emphasizing that it's possible that you have both arthritis and bursitis pain. And in that case, where you put the steroids is going to make a big difference in terms of what kind of relief you get. It's not always trivial to figure out whether pain in the groin or hip is coming from the back or coming from the hip. So I wouldn't fault the first doctors for what's turned out to be an incorrect diagnosis. I, in fact, know of a case where a patient of mine had multiple back surgeries for disc disease, because on an MRI he did have disc disease, to treat pain in the left hip. And it turned out that what he actually had was hip arthritis. And so after two back surgeries, somebody replaced his hip and his pain went away. Even with the best and smart doctors and the best medical care, you can make the wrong call on this situation. The second thing is the location of the pain. So pain on the outside part of the hip, the part of the hip that is the widest portion of the hip, the part that when you lie on your side at night is in contact with the bed, pain in that location is usually not from arthritis. More typically, it's from either a bursitis of the greater trochanter or a tight structure along the outside of the leg, along the outseam, if you will, where the tuxedo stripe would be on a pair of tuxedo pants. The iliotibial band. So that pain there is mechanical soft tissue pain. Bursa is a shock absorber pad that sits under that fibrous band, the iliotibial band, and protects it from being eroded away by rubbing on the surface of the bone, the greater trochanter or the femur. So you can get trochanteric bursitis. It's very common. And I treat that usually, first line treatment for me is to use steroids because they are so effective and so safe in that location. It's an easy place to get to with a needle in most people. If someone's very, very heavy, it can be a little problematic. And it responds very well if you can get the steroids into the bursa. It's contained. It doesn't get into the bloodstream. You don't get a lot of effects on the diabetes or effects on adrenal suppression or anything generalized and systemic like that. The problem with any steroid injection is if you inject it into, let's say, a blood vessel by accident, you can get a systemic effect. If you put it into a muscle, like a butt shot, you might, for an antibiotic, you're going to absorb it systemically as well. Into a bursa or into a joint, it's usually broken down locally and doesn't have a lot of systemic effect. Now, I'm not sure if they're planning on putting a steroid injection into your hip. Hip pain from arthritis usually is medial pain. It's in the interior part of the groin. Another way to tell arthritis pain versus soft tissue pain is that arthritis pain, usually passive movement, is quite painful. So in other words, if I'm not using my muscles at all and someone is just rotating my hip in and out, like putting me in a frog's legs position and then knock-kneed position, if that hurts, and especially if the pain is medial, that's probably arthritis pain. And while some doctors do put injections into the hip joint, that's a much more dangerous procedure because you're going into very deep structures there. So it's often done under some sort of radiographic guidance. And it isn't that common to have that as a step. So typically, we inject the bursa on the outside and see what difference that makes for the pain. And I suspect that's the direction that your therapeutics is going to be going, but I don't know that for a fact.
Okay, well, that gives me some guidelines here. Now, if for the arthritis part of it, what do I do with that?
Well, let's suppose that you have the external bursa injection with steroids, and it doesn't really make a big difference in your pain, but you don't hurt when you push on the outside of the hip, then at that point, you try to calm it down with anti-inflammatories. And you know I'm a big fan of fish oil and high doses of curcumin, as well as non-steroidals used properly. You try to back down the inflammation, and you try to do things like pool exercises. Water exercise is hugely beneficial for arthritis because you move the joint in a non-weighted environment. When you move the joint, you compress the cartilage like a sponge. And then when you release the cartilage, it sucks in nutritional fluid from the joint. So you get some healing, although you don't regrow new cartilage. You can definitely calm down inflammation and reduce pain, get the person back to a functional level. At the point when you can't get the person back to a functional level and their quality of life is affected, we have perfected joint replacement. The problem is you want to be at least 60, really, before you have your joint replacement. If you get your joint replaced at 40, then you're going to look at having another surgery between, say, 55 and 60, because the lifespan on these things just isn't long enough. So
I'm taking turmeric now, 600 milligrams twice a day.
And are you making your own turmeric capsules?
No. No, I bought a capsule, and it has bromelain in it.
Right, which is a enzyme that comes from papaya, and
yes.
It has some anti-inflammatory properties, mainly for musculoskeletal things, but it doesn't hurt to try it for arthritis.
Yeah.
The issue I have with your turmeric is that it may not be very bioavailable. Getting turmeric into the bloodstream has turned out to be difficult. It's poorly absorbed. So there's a trick, which is to include black pepper. It turns out that there's a compound in black pepper called piperazine, which vastly increases, like, you know, triple, quadruples the absorption of the curcumin, which is in the turmeric, and that's the active ingredient that has the anti-inflammatory properties. So looking for turmeric that has added piperazine, and this is available in multiple formulations, is a good strategy. And then if you don't have a history of ulcer disease, and you're still in pain after doing the high-dose fish oil and the turmeric, then going to a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory and the pool exercises before you jump to joint replacement would be a sensible, conservative approach.
I'm an avid water aerobics.
Good.
I've been doing that for 6 years.
Good.
And I understand that the warmer water is better for it when you have the arthritis.
Yes, there is some evidence that warmer water helps with analgesia and makes people more willing to exercise. I'm not sure if it's a psychological or a physiological effect, but I mean, why care? There's data it works better. Let's use the warmer water where possible.
Okay, and how high are you talking about the fish oil? I've been taking for a long time. I've been on 3,300 milligrams of the fish oil.
I usually go to taking the DHA plus EPA components of fish oil up to about 4,000 milligrams if I'm shooting for anti-inflammatory. Now that's about a tablespoonful of oil. So if you're thinking in terms of capsules, that's probably 12 capsules.
Ooh.
So it's a big dose. And yeah. At that point, I tend to have people just buy the oils and use them in a salad dressing because there are a number of companies that make very good deodorized fish oils that don't smell fishy at all and can be used as part of a salad dressing. And it's an easy way to get them in.
Oh, well, I could probably, through the day, take, you know, 4 or 5 of them at a time.
Yeah, if you are willing to do that, that's a good way to go.
Yeah, and also flaxseed. I throw some cold mill flaxseed oil or flaxseed in with my yogurt and stuff like that, so I'm getting some omega-3s that way. Also.
That's true. You are.
Yeah.
Now, the flaxseed, are you grinding it before you put it in?
It comes already ground.
Okay, store it in the freezer.
In the freezer.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
It goes,
I've done it in the refrigerator, yeah. But I will. I'll put it in the freezer.
I'd freeze it and just take small components out each week and put them in the fridge. Ground flaxseed loses its properties to oxidation very rapidly, but that doesn't happen if it's frozen. A better and cheaper alternative is to buy the flaxseed and get yourself a coffee grinder, get dedicated coffee grinder, and just grind it up yourself.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you for your guidance so much.
And thank you for your call. Good luck.
Yes.
Oh, and I should put out a word for, you know, my acupuncture colleagues, including my little acupuncture self sitting here on my left shoulder is saying,
yes.
Psst, psst, don't forget to mention acupuncture for arthritis.
Thank you. I'm trying to find a good one in my area, so I've been knocking on lots of doors to try it and figure out what to do with it. So.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Another email, this one from Nancy in Los Angeles. Seborrheic keratoses. I would love for you to do a show on seborrheic keratoses. I have these growths on my lower extremities, and my physician has told me to, quote, learn to live with it. He insists there are no effective treatment remedies. However, on alternative sites, people are using high-grade hydrogen peroxide, avocado oil, and chemical peels with some success. I would love to hear what you think on this subject before I try any of these treatments. Well, I think you're in an HMO, Nancy, and that's why your doctor didn't suggest freezing your seborrheic keratoses using liquid nitrogen. That's generally my first move, unless they're larger than a pencil eraser. Seborrheic keratoses look a little bit like barnacles, or I'm going way back now, but when I was in grade school, the boys would chew up the paper on the straws that we got at lunch, and then they would spit the little wads of paper through the straws and try to get them to stick to the ceiling. It was obviously very boring in class. All the ceilings were studded with these little barnacles of chewed up paper. And that's rather what, if you could imagine them kind of a brownish tan color, that's pretty much what these seborrheic keratoses look like. They look like they're stuck on for the most part. And they respond fairly well to freezing. You get maybe a 50-75% destruction rate, just like warts. And the other thing that I do a lot in my practice is I'll shave them flat and then use a cautery and cauterize the base. And I get good feedback from my patients that that prevents them from coming back. Now, the problem with seborrheic keratoses is that they can do recur. They tend to happen on sun-exposed parts of the body, and it's genetic. So they show up 30 or 40 years after your sun exposure. And some people, I remember one patient I had who literally was like a spotted leopard. She had so many SKs that indeed, in her case, it would have been so onerous to try to remove them that we did tell her to live with it and then have us remove and take care of the ones that were catching on her bra straps and her waistband and any part of her body where they were getting traumatized, because we don't like to repeatedly traumatize skin lesions. So let's go to this email from Carol in the Netherlands regarding presbyopia, which is farsightedness, being unable to read print, something that happens to most of us in our middle age. I'm a 60-year-old female who is considering surgical options to correct presbyopia. I've been using monovision contact lenses for over 10 years, and I'm simply tired of wearing the lens and having to fiddle with my eyes every night and morning. Also, the lens became dry at night, and I cannot really rely on them. There now seems to be a number of different procedures available. Can you comment on these procedures and those being tested? Should I wait until the outcomes of these different procedures are thoroughly evaluated? I live in the Netherlands, so if you know of the procedures here that may not be approved in the U.S., I would greatly appreciate your opinion on them. And Carol, I thought this was a great topic, and I'm going to be bringing you an interview with a local ophthalmologist who does the procedures that are approved in the United States. I know there are several people who are actually doing procedures in Mexico because they're not approved here. There are definitely lots of people shopping around the various presbyopia procedures, and all of them are, to me, a little bit creepy and not ready for prime time at this point. The ciliary muscle of the eye is the part of the eye that is responsible for bending the lens, and our lenses never stop growing. So over the years, more and more cells form in our lenses, and they get stiff. Meanwhile, the ciliary muscle tends to get a little stretched out and weakened, and the combination is that we can no longer bend our lens enough to accommodate or see close up. Hence the middle-aged, kind of between 40 and 60-year-old phenomenon of needing reading glasses. At this point, I am recommending that you allow other people to be the guinea pigs and allow these surgeries to compete and emerge. And I want to see 10-year data on late complications before I go under the knife myself for any presbyopia. I want to remind you that when LASIK first came out, it was not known about the complications. And over the course of about 10 years, lots of situations where people developed dry eye or issues with persistent keratitis or corneal irritation emerged. And the complication rates just climbed until they stabilized. And at this point, we haven't enough cases to say what the complication rate is. And, you know, realistically, a pair of reading glasses, you're in the fine tradition of one of the founding fathers of the United States, Ben Franklin, who invented the bifocal. And I think it's only patriotic for all Americans to wear reading glasses in honor of Ben, until such time as they really get this surgery nailed. Let's talk to Jackie in San Martin. Hello, Jackie. Welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi. Last week, I called because my husband was suffering with a week-long stomach ailment that actually sent him to the emergency room, you know, with no recommendations. And so I called, and he said to try the probiotics. He agreed on that, and he said maybe the famantidine wasn't the thing to do, and to try oregano oil. So right after we got off the phone, we trotted down to the local health food big chain vitamin shop, and I searched. And there was lots of oregano oil. I was a little distressed because it was really hard to tell one kind of oregano product from another.
Oh, but indeed.
I spent about 20 minutes, and I felt that I bought the best one I could. Actually, it was a company out of Santa Cruz. So I thought, well, maybe that's better. And we bought the oil of oregano, and we bought some probiotics. And I tried to find something that had lots of organisms and live ones, and then also bought enzymes just for the heck of it.
Right.
And got home, and he took a dose, and he thought he was going to throw up, and then he didn't. And a half hour later, he was really much better, which was like an amazing recovery rate. And I didn't let him eat all day, and he dosed himself like two or three more times, like when meals normally would be, but he just had like clear broth. And by the next day, he was eating meals and had no symptoms whatsoever.
Excellent. Excellent.
That was amazing.
I just finished reading the Quack Watch guy's book. Bennett's has this website called Quack Watch. And every time anything alternative works, what Bennett says is, well, they probably would have gotten better anyway. I'll just play devil's advocate. Yeah, exactly. And you've had it for a week and it's not getting better and boom, suddenly it's better. Anyway, I'm so glad to hear that. And the reason I advised those things was it sounded like undigested carbohydrates were getting to an overgrowth of bacteria or possibly yeast. You can't necessarily tell. They were taking that undigested starch and turning it into gas, which is why he was having all the bloating. And apparently I was correct. So your multi-pronged solution took care of it by increasing the digestive rate with the enzymes and killing the organisms with the oregano oil and replacing them with organisms better suited to not ferment excess carbohydrates with the probiotics. So congratulations.
And actually, for people that have horses, in a way it was so weird because we have horses and his symptoms were pretty much classic gas colic, which is exactly what you just described, which is too much carbohydrate getting into the horse's gut, and then they develop gas, and they have a very long intestine, and it's very difficult for them, and then they'll thrash about and really injure themselves. So mm-hmm. it was kind of odd, because I wanted to rush him to the vet, not to the emergency room. And you know what the vet will do is they will put a gallon of oil and water down a tube into the horse's stomach.
Really?
Sort of get things moving through. Yeah.
Oh, okay. A cathartic, in other words. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they used to use purges a lot back in the 17th and 18th centuries when maybe just like phlebotomy, you know, bloodletting, there are some clinical situations where that's an appropriate treatment. Interesting.
The only other thing I wanted to add is that it is really difficult to make those purchasing decisions because there were literally four shelves of yeah. each of the products, and I had no way to figure out
I
what
know.
Was good and what was oregano oil versus leaves versus
right.
what concentration
right.
of oil. It was right. really, I wish we could standardize that.
Well, there have been efforts made legislatively over the years, but interested parties on both sides have always found some sort of detail that makes it impossible for them to negotiate a solution that both sides can agree to. Where have we heard that before?
Anyway, thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Just on the subject, I had a little personal journey with this, which I'll share with you. Part of my socialization as a regular medical doctor is that you shouldn't sell vitamins or nutritionals out of your office because you have a conflict of interest, yada, yada. And in fact, you do kind of have a conflict of interest in the sense that you can say, well, you need this and I just happen to have it right here on the shelf. And if you're unscrupulous, you could certainly sell people stuff they don't need. On the other hand, if you're an unscrupulous doctor, you can do a lot more damage than that. You can sell them procedures that they don't need, which obviously has larger implications on both the pocketbook and the personal health. Over the years, I changed my mind. I came across products that were exemplary for their type. For example, Nordic Naturals fish oil is one that I use pretty much exclusively. Certain products that just work really well that I understand and can rely on consistently. And I found that when I sent people off to the health food store, sometimes what they purchased didn't work nearly as well. And then after a while, I began stocking certain things. And just recently, I've begun stocking a lot more. And I'm working to try to come up with a sort of minimum alternative pharmacopoeia that will, you know, hit the 90% of the stuff that I'm telling people to do, simply because of the deer in the headlights effect when you walk into a health food store. Now, I'm extremely educated about this. And, about 4 or 5 months ago, I agreed during that time that Highway 1 was knocked out. I took pity on a patient who was making the 5-hour ride from Big Sur to Santa Cruz for an appointment with someone else and went and did some shopping for him at the local health food store. And even though I knew exactly what I was recommending for him, it still took me 45 minutes to find 5 products because of exactly that. Which one's best? What's the dosing? You have to turn it over and look at that. The milligrams are all different. So I've kind of come around to the idea that, yeah, it's good to have a formulary. I'm still struggling with the sleaze factor because you go online and you look at some of the alternative medicine websites and here's our big product line and here's an article, generally a very informative, well-written, well-supported article that advocates the use of these substances and exactly these substances. Life Extension Foundation is another good example. They have a well-researched journal that comes out once a week that's written for the intelligent layperson and it's very good. Lots of information, well referenced, but you turn the page after the article and there it is, a big full-paged ad for their product. And I still haven't quite reconciled myself with the capitalism, conflict of interest aspect of this. I don't know if I'll ever overcome my initial socialization in that regard. Certainly there are a number of physicians out there who have, and I'll keep you posted on my journey. And let's go to our next caller, and that is John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John, and welcome to the program.
I have a question or a comment about the vision component of
yes, go ahead.
Your email. I have a problem with vision, and I couldn't get a significant amount of correction with the lenses that were being prescribed. And I was down on the cliff one day, and I was looking through my binoculars at the buoy, the mile buoy, and it was crystal clear. So I asked my optometrist, and he said, well, that's because there's two lenses. And I said, well, why don't I wear a contact and the other lens? And it improved my vision so much.
Interesting.
So I wear contacts and regular glasses.
So what a great idea. And thank you for calling in and suggesting that.
Okay, take it easy.
Bye-bye. So I had another email, this one from Judy in Monterey. I'm a healthy, active, 65-year-old woman who's had genital herpes since I was 20. My genital herpes has been under control since I began taking 1,500 milligrams of lysine a day. I also have herpes since I get a cold sore on my lip once a year when under stress. My questions are as follows. Based on this information, am I a good or a bad candidate for the shingles vaccination? And the answer is, it makes no difference. Just being a healthy 65-year-old woman makes you a candidate for the shingles vaccination. These two viruses are very distinct. Oral herpes and genital herpes are two different viruses. And the herpes zoster, which is the chickenpox that we're vaccinating against for shingles, is a cousin. They're really very distinct viruses. So there's no reason not to go forward with the shingles vaccine except for cost. It's a couple $100 if your insurance doesn't cover it to pay for something that reduces your chance of getting shingles by 50%. I heard you talk about Dr. Perlmutter's research on herpes 1 and Alzheimer's after the recent functional medicine conference, and I've been in a quiet panic ever since. My mother died of Alzheimer's. I'm wondering if I should be on Valtrex, or do you have an opinion on this? Thanks for your generous gift of time and knowledge to the community. And just to recap for those who missed the show, Dr. Perlmutter had made a presentation at the Institute for Functional Medicine conference in May about correlations between Alzheimer's disease and oral herpes. And he's been treating people with Alzheimer's with Valtrex as well as a number of other alternative-like therapies such as hyperbaric oxygen, and seeing improvement in their cognition. Now, this is scientific anecdotes. He hasn't published. There's no control group. So the quality of the information is based on whether or not you want to trust Dr. Perlmutter and allowing for the fact that it's difficult to test for cognitive function. So he could be fooling himself. That being said, the idea that Alzheimer's is an inflammatory illness is an idea that's been around for a while, and there's plenty of support for that. So it makes sense that reducing herpes, reducing inflammation might have an effect on cognition. And given that these agents are very safe, the Valtrex in particular, I would say that with a family history, I would probably get my ApoE4 checked, which is the variation on the ApoE protein. If you have one or two copies of ApoE4 and a family history of Alzheimer's, yeah, I'd probably be doing all of the things that you're supposed to do to reduce Alzheimer's. And those things include a number of very basic healthy habits, which is exercise, don't get depressed, don't smoke, control your hypertension, control your weight, and treat your diabetes. And as far as those things go, those are scientifically validated measures that reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. I was going to talk about this study, which was recently published in the journal Lancet Neurology, so I'll just jump to that right now and say that it's a good mathematical model for Alzheimer's that looks at these risk factors and shows that they have pretty solid evidence that they make a difference. Let's go to Teresa in Prunedale. Hello, Teresa. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good
Can
morning.
You hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
All right. I have a question about using hookworms as a treatment for Crohn's disease.
Okay, what's your question about that?
I wonder, is that possible? I mean, what is your opinion about the effectiveness of it, the safety of it?
Okay, well, let's start with whether or not we're using a human hookworm or an animal hookworm. The human hookworm has a life cycle that is interrupted by modern plumbing. Back when people had outhouses and, you know, pooped in the woods, hookworm created a significant parasite burden. And this was particularly in the southeastern United States, had a lot of anemia, and it really slowed people down. They were weak and tired. So that was a bad level of parasite. the kind of levels that are achieved by people using it therapeutically, and I want to mention this is completely non-FDA approved experimental therapy, but there are people who are doing it. There are people who will sell you the hookworm cysts, and you can take them. You need to take delivery outside of the United States. It can't be mailed into the United States, so far as I know. I have several patients who have used this therapy. I am kind of on the fence here. Interestingly enough, there is an old Chinese remedy for ulcerative colitis, or bloody flux is, you know, kind of the translation of the Chinese version of this, which is ground up earthworms. And I wonder if there isn't a component, cell surface antigens, on the surface of worms, particularly maybe parasites, but maybe even earthworms, that signals the immune system such that it downregulates the type of inflammatory response that we see in Crohn's disease. Now, the mechanisms have been elucidated for this. It does actually make sense. There's a plausible mechanism, and the research needs to be done. Two things standing in the way of this being approved in the United States are, first of all, the creepiness factor, which is enormous. And secondly, the fact that as a biological organism, this cannot be patented. So the funding to do this creepy research, and it's poop research on top of it also, the chances of it actually happening, I'd say, within the United States are pretty low, unless something really comes out of these European and Asian studies that's so persuasive that NIH or someone who's publicly funded like that decides to take it on.
But is there any, just quickly, are there any known enormous risk factors? My nephew is young, and he has it, and young, early 20s, and I'm thinking of it for him. Is there anything in...
Well, if we're talking about the human parasite, you're giving someone a human parasite. Other people are using pork whipworm, which doesn't propagate in the human, so you have to keep dosing it, but that is an alternative that would have very, very low risk factors. Anemia is the chief one with the whipworm or the hookworm. You know, that can be a big problem if you get anemia, but as I said, the colonies that generally are achieved by this alternative therapy aren't high enough for that to be a significant thing. I would like to see it used more. I also want to emphasize that your nephew, is your nephew correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that your nephew has to be very careful about his diet. If he has inflammatory bowel disease, he may already have multiple food sensitivities. He should get tested for those and avoid those foods. And he should rotate his foods so that he eats different types of proteins, fruits, vegetables, and not the same thing every day, because if he exposes himself to high levels of something, he's likely to develop secondary sensitivities to it, which will plague him later on and potentially even perpetuate the inflammatory response.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Maria in Watsonville. Hello, Maria. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Hi. I know that you're getting towards the end of the show, but I wanted to find out what your recommendations were in terms of EMF radiation exposure. And I don't have a particular situation, but just wanted to get your thoughts because you're so knowledgeable. And we have a cell phone tower that got approved by the Planning Commission within 300 feet of my house and also my employment. So I work and live in the same 300-foot radius. So I'm concerned. Suddenly, I'm trying to educate myself about what this do in terms of this exposure could do in terms of producing any health effects to children, because I do have young children and adults. And also I'm recently reading up about just all the exposure from smart meters, which haven't been installed here, and I'm on the delay list in addition to all the cell phone use EMF exposure. So I'm just wanting to get some education around this. I know you're really knowledgeable. I wanted to know what your thoughts are, what the possible health effects are, and what your recommendations are.
Well, the World Health thing about cell phones notwithstanding, I think that we have to look at cell phones as both in terms of putting it right up next to our ear and also the emissions from the towers as kind of along the lines of the creepy factor that I was talking about with regarding the worms with the earlier caller. Data has really been not that persuasive that there's a big risk associated with it. And we're now getting up to, you know, 10 years of lots and lots of cell phone use. And you see some studies that show you know, some blips. There's some tissue warming that occurs, maybe a small increase in the risk of fairly uncommon cancers, but it's not a big deal. Personally, from my standpoint, I don't think I could ever go back to not having cell phones, and so I think the genie's out of the bottle on that. And there isn't enough data to say that living near a cell phone tower is so terrible for you that we shouldn't, you know, that we should play NIMBY and not let there be one in my backyard. It's really important to distinguish between the type of radiation which you have from a cell phone and the type of radiation that you have from, say, oh, a nuclear plant in Japan melting down and putting fallout into the air, or a nuclear explosion, or for that matter, large amounts of x-rays, such as a CT scan. So I wanted to give you a reference to a website, and I will put this up on my own website, askdrdon.com, so you don't have to write this down. But there is an excellent radiation risk table that is proportionate, and just like, I can't remember his first name, but there's a guy named Tufte who does these really excellent seminars on how to visually present complex information. And this is a diagram that Tufte would love. Anyway, the website is xkcd.com/radiation. And if you go to that, and I will put a link up, as I said, you'll get a lot of education about the relative volumes of radiation of the different sources that can damage your DNA. I want to emphasize cell phones and cell phone towers do not damage your DNA directly in the way that ionizing nuclear or X radiation does.
Okay.
Okay. So take a deep breath, for starters. You want to support your health. You want to be sure that you exercise, eat a good diet, and do all of these other things that allow your body to deal with small amounts of toxicity, and that includes electromagnetic toxicity. And I do have patients who really do seem to be very disrupted by electromagnetics, and I definitely believe in field phenomenon. After all, I'm a part-time acupuncturist, so I believe in field phenomenon having an effect on the body. But when we put it across a large group of people, we're not seeing the kind of risk that would justify a social policy against it.
So it sounds like then it might be like the folks that get affected by, for example, sick building syndrome, which isn't the general population.
Exactly. There are people who just
that are very sensitive, and it's real, and they're not crazy, and they're not, but they are affected. And it's, I guess that's the part, it's impossible to know who will be affected, I guess.
Well, actually, you kind of already know. It's the people who have the multiple reactions already. They're the ones who are evincing that they have physiologic problems that allow them to be easily discombobulated, shall we say.
Okay.
So you're supporting your health and watching to make sure that you keep your detoxification good, keep yourself strong. I think you should be okay.
Okay. I appreciate your help. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I will make the commitment to people that I am going to do some research on the smart meters. It's been on my list of things to do, and I haven't done it, so I'll try to get to that by next week. Let's go to Jean in Watsonville. Hello, Jean. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Dr. Don, I have a question about dengue fever.
Dengue fever. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm in my late 50s, and in my 30s had a go-around with dengue fever when I was in the South Pacific.
Okay.
And just with what I'm hearing on the news with mosquitoes and, you know, the new climate and mosquitoes, I'm wondering if you can help me understand what my risk might be to go into an area where there are mosquitoes that have the virus.
I would stay away from areas that have the virus. And if I had to go in, I would use, this would be the moment to get out the DEET and the mosquito repellent clothing. By the way, you can buy pyrethrin or permethrin at the veterinary store and spray it on your clothes. It's a chrysanthemum-based chemical, although there is a synthetic version. Anyway, the point is you get your clothes sprayed down like you were going to iron them and then let it dry. And that'll last through 3 or 4 washings. So long sleeves, long pants, lightweight, spray it down with the pyrethrin, wear the DEET on the exposed parts of your body, because the first episode of dengue that a person gets gives them the flu. No big deal. The second, third, fourth case of dengue that the same person gets, once their immune system has already been primed and exposed to dengue, can result in a very severe hemorrhagic fever, which causes your blood vessels to break, your blood cells to break down, release massive quantities of hemoglobin into the bloodstream and kill your kidneys, or at least take them down and put you on dialysis for a couple of months. You don't want to go there. And unfortunately, it is the problem that if you were back in the South Pacific, you'd only be exposed to the South Pacific dengue, you'd probably be fine. But when you go to, say, Thailand or El Paso with the global warming issues that, or the global climate change issues, because it sure isn't warm here. But what we're seeing is where the mosquitoes are moving in, they're carrying different strains of dengue than the one you've been exposed to. And potentially, if you get that second strain, you could have this massive immune cytokine storm and have a very severe complication.
Okay.
So I would stay away from mosquito-borne parts of the United States and take precautions when I went to visit.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the information, and really appreciate all you do.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. And let's take a moment and regroup here. I have just a minute. So maybe using this last email from Chris in Boulder Creek. I'm taking Ativan to help with sleep and anxiety. It's been helpful, but I've been using this for about 2 or more years, although my doctor only allows me 21 milligram tablets every 30 years. I'm just wondering if there is something now that can help with these issues that may be more like an antidepressant. I do need to say that SSRIs do not work in my family, creating more anxiety. I am involved in personal counseling and acupuncture. Both have been effective. What else can you suggest, basically, is what Chris is asking. And the first thing I would say is hats off and A-plus to your doctor, because being on a diet of 20 Ativan per month keeps you from getting into a situation where the Ativan stops working because you start using it so often that your body gets used to it. So kudos to your doctor. Effexor is another type of antidepressant that generally does not cause a lot of anxiety. If you feel significantly depressed and you want to try treatment with a standard antidepressant, that would be the way to go. High-dose SAM-E, which is a natural component, at about 1,600 milligrams a day, works as well as Prozac for depression and does not have anxiety as a side effect. It does take about a month to kick in, however, and it's expensive. It'll cost you $50 a month. For anxiety, I also recommend the use of magnesium glycinate. Magnesium comes in multiple different salts. The glycinate is the most absorbable, and also glycine is a precursor for GABA, which is gamma-aminobutyric acid, which is the calming neurotransmitter, the opposite of glutamate, the yin to glutamate's yang. So these are all ways of treating it. And also some people do take GABA orally and find that it works for them. So that's definitely something to look into for you. We've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank you for joining me, and I hope you'll join me next week. And also check out the website, AskDrDawn.com. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.